This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Sarah Yost about her contemporary novel, One Last Chance. Sarah was born and grew up in Switzerland and moved to the UK in 2008 to learn English for a year and somehow didn't manage to leave. She now works as a French teacher and pastoral manager in a girls' school and lives in Buckinghamshire with her husband and Golden Shepherd. In this episode, we discuss writing as a non-native speaker, the challenges of writing a time loop love story, and how Sarah tries to practice what she calls writer's mindfulness to cope with the challenges of being published. But first, here's Sarah with an excerpt from One Last Chance.
Monday, 15th of July, 2019. Baby elephants can die of loneliness. I'm hiding at the darker end of the room, in its village pub erected so close to the church that either would crumble without the other. I sneaked out after the service, now at the wake, while I wait anxiously for somebody to come and ask how I knew Nick. I didn't, not really. I'm reviewing my life and regrets, basking in the proximity of death like a chicken roasting in its own juices, compressing the past 4 years of my life into my brain, trying to figure out where it's all gone wrong. Time is a funny thing, I tell Yuki when she returns. She went to offer her condolences to the family, all huddled together in the bay window. She leans next to me against the bar. The voices around us are muffled, the carpet dappled in burning puddles of sun. There's a garden out there, full of grass and flowers and cats, but it must have been deemed too hot, too cheery for the occasion, or nobody could stand to be judged by cats today, and I can't blame them. Yuki checks her glass, which still stands empty where she left it. Was I supposed to get her another drink, be her funeral wingwoman? She sighs as she orders, the tips of her fingers drumming on the bar. Her nail polish is unusually flaky, like the paint of those neglected houses by the seaside. That's all I seem to be able to see in England nowadays. The crumbling plaster, the burst fast food bags, the electric wires threatening to come loose. Yeah, I know what you mean, Lou, she says. If only we could back and see Nick again. Of course, I say. Yuki's eyes are deep, slightly swollen, ringed with eyeliner, gone blurry. I mean, this is such a tragedy. But, go on, I know you have something on your mind. I can't stop thinking I've messed up my life. Oh, mate, you and me both.
Hi, Sarah, welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, One Last Chance.
Hi, Chloe. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Sarah, can you start by introducing your novel for us and tell us what One Last Chance is about?
So One Last Chance is a time loop love story. The main character is Louise. Lou, she's a Swiss national living in the UK. She's been there for a couple of years. And at the start of the novel, she is attending the funeral of a friend of a friend. And that really makes her kind of think about her life and the decision she made to move to the UK. And she finds that she's actually not really progressed or made connections, and she's feeling really kind of low at that point. Then she finds out that her ex in Switzerland, who she's still kind of in love with, has got engaged, and that kind of spirals a kind of time seizure, one could say, that comes with almost like a panic attack feeling of intense regrets and worries about the future. And she goes back in time to 2 years ago, when she feels she might have kind of missed the opportunity to change her life. So it is a kind of time loop love story that is about those five times that she goes back in time and the different choices she makes along the way.
And she goes back to the birthday party of her friend and flatmate. And there's just, I can remember a very brilliant scene where she's got this ginormous fruit basket that she's trying to kind of hide, because she realizes at that precise moment what a disastrous gift that is to bring to a birthday party.
Especially in a pub on a Friday or Saturday night. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I think that tells you what you need to know about Lou. She's well-intentioned, but she's really awkward. She second-guesses everything, ends up making really awkward choices and not really stand by them at the beginning. So she's really struggling to communicate, you know, her love and friendship for her friend in the right way. And she just gets so caught up in her head, full of anxiety, that she ends up just making, yeah, getting in those quite tricky and awkward situations.
So can you talk us through where the inspiration came from for this novel? Was there a moment where you can kind of pin it all back to? Was there a kind of a lightning bolt for you, or did it come to you over a long period of time? What was the kind of moment of inspiration for you?
Yeah, I wish I could say that it was a light bulb moment. I mean, I remember one conversation with my now husband in the car. I had just written the first draft of another novel that was set in Iceland and really kind of dark, about domestic abuse and stuff like that. And I was feeling really depressed because there's no sunlight there and everything was dark and damp and sad. And I just kind of turned to him and I said, maybe I want to write something a bit lighter, a bit more closer to home, something that I can, you know, kind of where I can be more sympathetic or empathetic with the main character, understand her more, and something maybe a little bit happier. So I decided to write a love story at that point. And I'd always been interested in how mental health affects our perception of time, and that idea of anxiety and of being trapped in regrets in the past and trapped in the future and your worries, and kind of what would happen if a character was so anxious that actually triggered a time loop for them. So that's how it kind of came together. I mixed the two concepts of an exploration of mental health in that way and wanting to write a love story and putting a character who is really fundamentally anxious in the worst possible situation for her, where something, you know, really difficult happens and she has to face it over and over again, potentially.
Yeah. And I'm guessing by the sounds of this that you have written several novels in the past, or at least attempted to finish and write novels. Did you have a moment then when this one felt like it was the right fit for you, or you kind of thought, I'm getting some sort of tingly feelings of this has potential? Did you feel that with this book?
I think it did. I think it felt a bit maybe more personal than the other books. It was obviously a contemporary kind of storyline, so it felt a bit more kind of immediate to my own experience. I decided to have a main character that's quite close to myself in terms of certainly that idea of being an expat and having kind of uprooted your life and gone to another country and having to come to find your identity and find a life for yourself there, feeling a bit trapped between two countries, two choices, and the people you left behind and the new people you meet. So I think that felt really quite authentic for me, I think. And that is what made me really stick with this story and really start working on it. I also ended up applying and getting into the Curtis Brown 3 months course with the opening of that novel. So I got the opportunity, the amazing opportunity to work on it, to workshop it with my 14 teammates, course mates, and Charlotte Mendel's son as well, who is amazing. So I ended up working much more seriously on this one than I had ever done before. So it was kind of those circumstances of believing the story, but then getting that boost of getting on the course and suddenly having people believing it in it as well and carrying me through it, through that draft, which really helped me.
Yeah, almost kind of giving you that validation that it's what
yeah.
you're doing with. It's
yeah,
hard.
And I think especially as a non-native speaker, I had no idea whether I was writing gibberish in a language that wasn't really mine, whether that made any sense or whether it sounded odd. And, you know, it was amazing to get the feedback, especially the first passage that we workshopped. I was amazed that people were not saying like, what is this word? Or like, you misunderstood my language completely. You know, it was great to get really encouraging responses on it.
Have you written in, I don't know what your first language is, have you
French.
Written French? Yeah, have you written
yeah.
in French?
I did. I wrote a lot when I was a teenager, so I started when I was about 10. You know, I wrote in school exercise books, and I used to write novels, so it would be like about three A4 exercise books together and give it to my friends. So I wrote a lot in French. I did a lot of competitions for young authors in my teenage years as well, and I got a few prizes and got to kind of meet other young authors who wrote in French and from, you know, Belgium and France and the Ivory Coast and like amazing places.
Wow.
So I got that experience, but once I started going to uni, I stopped writing fiction, writing creatively, until I finished my master's. So that was quite a few years where I did a bit more academic writing. And then I moved to the UK right after my studies. And that's when I thought, well, I'm just going to learn English first from scratch. I didn't know English at all before. So that was the idea, was to do something completely different. And obviously it took me a few years until I felt confident, or I felt even the impulse to start writing again. Yeah, so that was quite the journey to get to this stage.
Yeah, it blows my mind. It really does. Like I was absolutely hopeless at languages at school, and the fact to come over and learn a whole new language and be able to write so beautifully in it is just, you know, that is a whole skill in itself, Sarah. I mean, it's very commendable. Was it a different experience, like kind of writing in English, where you, maybe there were I imagine there's words that you want to use that French that then you're like, there's no equivalent.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I've lived here for now 15 years. So I think and speak English. I know I still don't really sound like a native speaker, but for me, I'm almost more proficient now in English because of, I think your 20s are so formative that I kind of spent, you know, half of my 20s and most of my 30s in the UK. So I kind of grew so much with the language that I almost developed a whole new kind of range of emotions attached to the words in English. So I kind of couldn't really write in French anymore. But I've thought a lot about that now because the French translation of my book has just come out in France. And I've had a lot of questions from really bemused friends who were like, so is it you who wrote the translation, but it's your first language? And no, I'm not, you know, I didn't translate my own book. I don't think I could actually do it because of all the idioms and all the expressions.
Yeah.
And as you say, you think and you kind of feel and your characters feel with the words that they have available. And if I just knew if I even tried to translate some of it, it would get very frustrating and very annoying for me. So I was like, best leave it to the professionals. And I did a really amazing job. But yeah, it's I think English is now my writing language. I don't think I could go back to French. And even now I second guess so much of what I write in French, even on, you know, social media. I'm just like, is it just translated from English or is it actually natural in French? I think I find that completely fascinating that it can be my first language, but it's become a little bit more remote from me and less immediate or less authentic for me potentially.
Have you picked up your French edition and had a read of
Not yet.
it?
No, not yet. But it's literally just come out, so I've seen. I started to see pictures from friends and family who have seen it in
Oh
Fnac
wow,
and
nice,
kind of
yeah.
highlighted. So I need to chase up to get a copy from my publisher, to be
Mm,
honest. But yeah, it is quite a strange experience to read yourself back through somebody else's words in your
yeah.
own language. Yeah.
I can imagine, I can imagine. That's fascinating. I wanted to touch on something you actually mentioned about your main character, Lou, because obviously she shares some similarities with you, with the main one being that she's also Swiss and living in the UK and has done for a while. Were there aspects of that experience that you really wanted to write about? Because I suppose it's quite a unique situation that we don't read often in novels.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in the book that I wanted to mention. I mean, we talked about the language aspect, and she uses a few French words here and there. I don't want to scare anybody off of the book, but a few words. So she's kind of using the most fitting word when she needs something in French, and she's kind of in her language. She's a bit between the two places. I think the main thing was for me to show the experience of being torn between two places, and it's not something that is really deep in terms of cultural, maybe because England and Switzerland, quite similar countries in some ways. But I think it was that idea of the people you leave behind, the choice you make of leaving your family. And all of my family is still in Switzerland, and I've got a brand new niece as well. So that's made things even more, I'm not there to see her grow up, and I have to kind of go back to see her. It's you're leaving your people behind, and they live the life that you've always known them to have, but suddenly your life is very different, and it can't always relate to that. Even if they come and visit you, they feel you've kind of left. They don't really understand your choice because that's not the one they've made. But you also want to kind of build a new life, and you find yourself in a country where you don't have any university friends. You don't have any of those connections you would normally have. You can't call your dad when you're 24 and you break down on the motorway, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I thought that was quite interesting for me to explore in terms of human connections. And I say it's a love story. It is. There's definitely a romantic love story at the heart of the book, but for me, it is a story of connection with all the kind of different loves you have in your life, your family, your sister, your best friend, or the friends you might make. And I thought that was really important to show somebody wrestling with that. And there's no easy solution. It's not that one choice was necessarily better, but it's the choice you're making and kind of sticking to it and working on it and building your connections wherever you decide to be. I think that was quite interesting for me to explore.
Let's touch a little bit on that love story then between Nick and Lou, because I often think people think, and it's particularly because it's kind of genre snobbery, that writing love stories or romance stories are easy, and any of us that have attempted it will know that it's not. But obviously you've had to create this chemistry between Nick and Lou, and in multiple scenarios as well, because we're meeting them at several, different times and different chances. So how did you build this love story? Tell us about that kind of connection and chemistry on the paper.
I think it's so interesting that you're asking that because I generally thought I'm just going to write a love story, easy, that bit is fine. The time loop is going to be the hard one to figure out. And then I sat down and I said to my husband, I was like, what actually makes people fall in love? I have no idea. What, how, why do we fall in love with somebody and not somebody else? It's not because of stuff you can, list on paper necessarily. I mean, you have values and common values and common dreams and aspirations, maybe common hobbies and stuff like that. But fundamentally, I just realized I had no idea how to to write it, how to show it. But I think what I did was to have two characters who had were quite complementary in a way, I think, who bring out the best of each other when they meet. I think for me, Nick was really important to get right as a romantic kind of lead, romantic partner. And fundamentally, I just wanted him to be a nice guy. I wanted him to be what I found attractive in a partner, which is somebody who listens genuinely to the person in front of them, gives them kind of space, gets under maybe sometimes their quirks or their kind of anxieties as well, and somebody who is just nice and generous. But I don't like the trope of, you know, when you've got one of the partners in the book, in a rom-com, who is really, really annoying and pushes somebody else away all the time. And then the other person keeps coming back. And you're like, well, in real life, you would kind of take the message and maybe just be like, okay, I got it, you know, or, you know, you're a bit annoying, or you're just not really for me. So I wanted to show that Lou, when she approaches Nick for the first time, she's not really thinking about him. So she kind of doesn't have all those hang up, so she doesn't have those moments of kind of thinking about how she's going to present herself to him or trying to make him like her. She just goes as she is, and she kind of struts up to him and asks him for advice, and she has her mind completely on something else. So she really lets her guard down with him, and I think that shows him something a lot more kind of sparky and quirky and sweet and interesting than maybe she presents herself when she feels that she really needs to be liked by other people. So I just wanted to, it was really important for me that she approached him and he kind of saw something in her, but he was also holding something back from her that she needs to find out as she gives him more space as well. So she has to learn to listen to him as well. So I kind of made that love story on the different steps they take together to uncover their authentic selves and to support each other in that way, but they bring the best out of each other, I think. That's a very long answer to your simple question, but
you're absolutely right. And I think like you say, it is harder than it looks, and I think it is about kind of uncovering those things within our characters that are hidden and that only they know, but that their partner has got to somehow discover or bring out.
I think falling in love
bringing them out under their shell or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think falling in love is a process of opening up, isn't it? And I think the idea of that time loop was amazing in that way, because it enables them to open up more and more every time they kind of redo things, to kind of find out different things in each other, and little clues as to what might have happened in their past kind of come to life and start making sense. And I think that was great. I mean, the opportunity to redo your relationship over and over again until you kind of know each other so well that you're kind of ready to really start is quite amazing, I think.
Tell us more about this time loop then, because so much fun. I love time loop stories. I kind of find them, the whole idea of them, just completely fascinating and addictive to read, although I have never attempted to write one because it just seems so hard. So tell us about how you kind of made all the rules and decided, because obviously every chance is slightly different and there are changes that take place. How did you kind of make each chance compelling enough so that the reader wasn't just like, oh, well, I know what's going to happen here, or I've seen this scene before. Tell us about how you kind of created that aspect.
I think I made things easier for myself by giving myself a bit of a longer loop. So it's about 2 years. It depends. Sometimes she goes back a bit earlier. But it wasn't a Groundhog Day where it's the same day over and over again, which I know some people do really, really well. Mm. But that would have really scared me. So I had the opportunity for Lou to live in different places, to kind of, you know, go back to Switzerland. She ends up much further afield at some point as well. So that was really good because I had a lot of time to play with, and she had really time to make different choices and see them pan out. I was really naive about it, to be honest with you, Chloe. I just kind of just threw myself into it and started putting dates down, and I didn't know which dates to put down, so I kind of used my family's birthdays, and I was like, well, something will happen on that date in August. What is it? And then I just started writing. So then I knew the key beats of her story. There's obviously a couple of Christmases. There's like the funeral of her grandmother, for example, and kind of there's a really important day in March and kind of where she is. And then I just started seeing where she might be in that loop and where she might end up, what could happen on those specific days. I didn't find that aspect that difficult, but what was hard and what I really worked on with my editors was to make sure that what happened in one loop was the, you know, the reason why she made the decisions that changed the next loop. So it was that kind of coherence and that chain of cause and consequence that I had to really make sure that I got right. So that was the harder bit. Otherwise, I just had the scenes and I just wrote them as they were, but just linking it all together, make sure it was part of a proper journey of change for her, and it was all coherent, was much harder.
Did you have kind of rules that you set for yourself? Because I'm kind of trying to avoid spoilers here.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Put this without being spoilery. There are, let's say, I want to say like leaks within the chances where she might not be the only one that feels like she's experienced this time before. If that makes sense to you, with being vague as possible. How did you kind of decide all those rules? Was it something that you just felt like you needed characters to shift kind of with her emotionally?
I think I tried to mainly make it that her attitude and her outlook and the way she is with other characters is the main catalyst for the change in other characters. But you're right, there's another character especially that I think if you read to the end of the book and then you go back, you kind of think, oh, actually, there were clues there that, you know, she's not necessarily the only one who's experiencing something to do with her timeline. That came a bit later. That was almost like an extra that I kind of added in once I had that idea that could work in. But I think the main thing was to try and make sure that changes in other characters, for example, her sister and her best friend, didn't just come out of the blue. And for example, the first time that she goes back, the first day, she's as you said at her best friend's birthday party, and she brings that awesome but really awkward massive fruit basket as a present because she needed it. And I kind of played with the way that she presents that present and the way she is with her best friend gives her a completely different reaction to the gift. But it was quite tricky to try and make sure that it wasn't just because she's back and it has to be different that her best friend suddenly has a completely different attitude towards her. So that was quite tricky. But yeah, I'm really fascinated with the idea of time being, again, linked to how we're feeling emotionally and our mental health and some, you know, some illnesses we might have, like anxiety and depression and stuff like that. So other characters who might experience, and I think they all at some point go through different things that might also affect their perception of time themselves, I think.
I'd love to talk a little bit more, Sarah, about your kind of writing process in general, because I know you have a very intense job which takes up a lot of your time, and I wondered how you fit your time to write really around your day job.
With great difficulty is the answer, which I'm sure a lot of people with demanding jobs will say, or any job really, full stop. I think writing, as you know, is so demanding. I think people don't always understand that it's not about the hours. It's not about the you know, there is a physical exhaustion to it as well, but it's like the cerebral exhaustion and the emotional exhaustion of it. So even if you had, even if I had like 9 hours, I could do it in a day, as I've just done it during my school holidays. I've kind of had to turn out a new draft. I can't write those many hours. So it just takes so much that in 2 or 3 hours in a day, you're kind of exhausted. You've given everything you had to give. Well, certainly in my case, I know everybody's a bit different. So coming back from a really difficult, a really demanding teaching job, I'm really lucky that I work in an amazing school, but it's very demanding as well. There's a lot of pressures on me. I'm part of the pastoral team as well. So there's that whole other aspect to the teaching and delivery of lessons, is that you have to kind of
support academically and emotionally a lot of young people who come and bring their issues to you, and you have to kind of try to coach them through it. So coming back after, you know, 9, 10 hours of this and then having to go sit down and do 1,000 words, it's really, really hard. I haven't found the right way to do it. I do it when I have to for a deadline, and I do it because I'm scared of not meeting my deadline if I kind of drop the ball, basically. But it's really, really difficult. I find the first draft easier to do. Just bashing out 1,000 words is fine, but it's when it really gets tough and you have to turn that into a proper book. The editing process I find really, really hard. So I try to use my school holidays to do it. But that means I don't really get a holiday. I just get two jobs.
Yeah.
But you know.
So do you tend to sit there at weekends, or I'm guessing you don't have any time in the evenings, because I know how demanding teaching is. But do you just sit there and say, I have to get 1,000 words done? Or are you a kind of a little bit kinder to yourself, and you kind of write when you kind of are ready to write, or do you not have the opportunity?
No, I'm trying to be really disciplined, but I also know that, for example, the summer term is easier because it's a bit lighter. I teach in a secondary school, so I kind of usually lose a couple of exam classes. The days are longer, so I know I can get more done in the summer term. So between Easter and kind of October is better. I'm tougher on myself at that time. In the winter sometimes, I mean, it depends what stage you are in the process, really. It's quite difficult, but in the winter it's really, really hard to write after work. So I might do it, but again, I might have the time to do it in theory, but it's that availability, that emotional kind of bucket that is empty often. So it's quite hard, but it helps to be quite disciplined. And it helps to kind of take the pressure off in terms of that first draft and just kind of trying to get the words out. But yeah, it's, you know, it's like when you have a hobby that you really, really love, that is your passion, and it turns into your job, suddenly it just comes with all sorts of changes in terms of the way you approach it. And it just becomes slightly less enjoyable at times. Mm-hmm. But when it works, it's still worth it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So can you talk us through your journey from writing this book and beginning this book? And then I know you had a period of time on the Curtis Brown creative course. Mm-hmm. How did you go from the early stages of this book to getting your agent?
Yeah, so I tried to get on the Curtis Brown course with my previous book, The One Set in Iceland. That was really, really dark. And that didn't work out. And I was really, I had set my mind on, I want to do this seriously now. And that course seems perfect for me to get to know the industry, to kind of meet some like-minded writers. So I kind of started writing this book, One Last Chance, and I sent my opening, the first 10,000 words, I think, in, and I got selected. So it was quite quick in terms of beginning to write the book, getting on the course, and it was a 3-month course. It was absolutely amazing. So I kind of kept writing, and I used the momentum from the course, which also coincided, I think, our end of course drinks with agents was literally a week before lockdown, or 2 weeks before the first lockdown. So that was March 2019. Mm. So suddenly the whole world was kind of upside down. But I also found myself with not having to commute into work, even if I was still teaching a full timetable from my computer, because my school was doing all the lessons were kind of online, face to face. So it destroyed my eyes and my back, I have to say, that period. But I think it gave me a little bit more of that time in the day to kind of finish the draft, send it to a few people. And by the end of the summer, I was ready to send my draft to people. Was it that year, or am I getting a little bit too quick? I think it might have been the summer after. Sorry. So a whole year of kind of lockdowns on and off, and I managed to finish my first draft, to do a couple of kind of beta readers rounds, and kind of edited the best I could, and to start submitting it. I think I submitted to about 25 agents, and then I got, it took about 6 months, so I think between September and January, until I got a few kind of full manuscript requests. I didn't really lead to anything, but eventually I had 3 offers of representation, and I signed with my amazing agent, who was Olivia Maidman at Madeleine Milburn, and she's absolutely fantastic. So I'm really pleased with my choice. But yeah, it was quite a kind of business-like process of sending those emails, getting those rejections, and getting a couple of enough interest that I kind of thought I had maybe something going. But yeah, it was slow in some aspect and quick in some others.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you've got I don't know whether it's unique, actually, because I've seen it happen a few times, that your title in the US and the title in the UK are different. Do you know the kind of discussions that happened about that? Or did they tell you why they were changing the title?
I think so. I wasn't completely privy to the discussions. I think that was mainly my agent discussing with the both editors, but they just couldn't agree on the titles. I think, as I understand it, the UK wanted something a bit more kind of wistful and a bit more melancholy, One Last Chance, you know, that idea of kind of trying to get it right one last time.
Yeah.
Whereas the US wanted something a bit more positive and upbeat, with 5 first chances. You get your first chance 5 times. I really like both titles. I think it's just been a little bit confusing, I think, for some readers to know whether it's the same book or not. I got a former student of mine who contacted me recently and said, which book is it? It's the same one. So that was a shame in terms of that kind of clean marketing line and kind of having the benefits of both marketing campaigns for the same book. But actually it's worked out really well, and both editors did a really good job on it.
Mm. What was your experience like with working with a US and a UK editor? Did they work on the book together, or was it kind of done and then it got sent to the US? What was the
process like there? It was done with the UK and then was sent to the US. And then she wanted to do, so MJ wanted to do more changes on, especially I was talking, I think, earlier about the making sure that there's a really clear chain of cause and consequences in terms of the decisions and where Lou finds herself or decides to, the choices she makes. So there was a little bit of tweaking done, but I think it was quite a quick round of edits, if I'm really honest with you, compared to what I'm going through on book 2. It was really quick. But yeah, it was really interesting because she picked up on things that my UK editor hadn't, and the other way around. But then the UK was really, really happy to go with the same changes. So it's basically the same version, except for American spellings and a few kind of different tweaks that the both copy editors made. The content is the same, and I'm really pleased that I went with the same edits in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was a lot of runs of edits for me.
So when it comes to your experience of being published and the whole kind of publishing journey, we hear a lot, and particularly the conversation at the moment seems to be talking a lot about the general kind of ups and downs of being a first-time author and a debut novelist. What would your advice be to next year's cohort about how to cope with or deal with the kind of general roller coaster experience of being published?
Gosh, I don't know how long we have.
It's, as long as you want, Sarah.
It's been really hard. It's been amazing, but it's been really hard. And I think you can't take the amazing away from the hard and the hard away from the amazing. It's just both sides of the same coin. Like my protagonist, I do suffer from anxiety, which is quite mild and manageable, but still can flare up quite a lot. So I think finding yourself, we were talking earlier about a position of being out of control and kind of releasing something that is really personal to you into the world and starting getting, you know, reviews and reactions, it's a really difficult process to get through, and you have to toughen up a little bit. But I think the main advice I would give would be to really try and understand how you work, not necessarily your process, because I don't understand my process yet, and I hope I will one day, but I don't at the moment. But maybe understand what triggers you to feel really anxious or to feel really high or to feel really low, and try and really manage your expectations of the whole thing. Give yourself the right boundaries as well. For example, we were talking as well before we started recording about, you know, how much social media you should be doing, how proactive you should be. And full-time job or not, everybody has other things in their life. And I think it could be a full-time job that you just manage your social media, you kind of interact with readers. I think it's really important that you decide with yourself what is reasonable for you to do, what you're prepared to give to that aspect of things, and that you don't kind of burn yourself out with that and not have anything left for the writing. You keep your writing at the center of what you're doing. I think comparing yourself to other writers is really easy to do and really difficult as well. So I think always like to remind myself of that idea of, you know, scarcity mindset, and just avoid thinking down the lines of, you know, if they're doing really, really well, that means there's less chance of me doing well. It's an easy thing to do. And I know a lot of people are really open and talking about jealousy. It's quite human to think, because your experience will not be, there's always going to be a lot of people who will be more immediately successful than you. But I think it's about you and your own journey and your own enjoyment of what you're doing, and kind of keep thinking about what is really important and why you're doing what you're doing. You're not doing it for the Netflix deal. You're doing it because, you know, you have something to say, or you're enjoying just sitting down and writing worlds and characters, or you're using it to connect with other people and to kind of leave a little mark on the world. So I think that's just kind of trying to shut down the noise a little bit. Practicing some kind of writer mindfulness is really good. But obviously there's ups and downs, and it's quite difficult to do sometimes. Yeah, those boundaries are important, I think. Social media, just shut it down if you're starting to make you feel sad, and then go back once you're feeling more kind of able to celebrate everybody's successes with them, which is the way it should be.
It's funny how just seeing one thing can make you, I don't know, doubt yourself or
spiral a bit.
Yeah. Or you know, you're suddenly jealous, or you're suddenly thinking, yeah, am I doing it wrong? Am I not doing enough? And it can literally be one post on Twitter or Instagram or anything, and you just suddenly are thrown into this. I had something happen last week, which I texted one of my friends about, and I was like, this is never going to be me, and I'm never going to, and you did have to give me a good stern talking to. It can happen. Yeah. But I think, yeah, like you say, there's a lot of work that we have to do to kind of keep our heads out of that side of it, and it's easier said than done. But the more that we can stay focused on the writing and the work and the reason why we're all here is the key to it all, really.
And just reminding ourselves that it's an amazing achievement to have put our words into the world and to have people reading them. But I think it's so fundamentally human to feel like that. Like, it's not about beating yourself up about it either. But it's giving yourself permission to step out sometimes and just really keep checking in with yourself when you get into those spirals. That I think is really important. And you never know, you know, the next day can bring the big news that you want. You know, the next book you write might be the big one, or, you know, it's yeah, I think defining success is a really important thing as well. Like, what does success look like to you? And I know I've listened to a lot of your podcasts, and there's a lot of authors talking about the moving goalposts of writing. You know, if only I had an agent, if only I had the book deal, if only I had an American book deal, and all of that. And it's
and on and on and on and on. Yeah.
Yeah, so easy to get caught up in it, when actually the only thing you can do is to be as authentic as you can, and to put your words on paper and do the best you can for yourself and for whoever will pick it up. And I think that's, easier said than done sometimes, but that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've sort of hinted already that it's been a bit of a struggle, but finally, Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about book two? What are you working on at the moment?
Yeah. So book two is going to be a little bit different. I think it's still contemporary fiction, still about a woman who there is a little bit of a speculative element as well. So it's somebody who is what I would call an art empath, maybe. She can access works of art and kind of tap into the emotions of the artist who's made them. And she's called to authenticate works by an artist who was very personal to her in a big castle in Brittany in France. So I mainly set the book there because I wanted to have an excuse to go and do some research on the terrain. So I had a lovely week in Brittany this summer, which was amazing, visiting a lot of castles and kind of immersing myself into the Arthurian legends of the place and all the fairy stories and everything. So that was great. But yeah, she just realizes that there's something that might not be what it seems. But she's also struggling with burnout, so she's not really able to access her gift as much as she would like. So it's kind of her trying to sort out the fact from the fiction and thinking about what her values ought to be in this world of art. So that's where I'm at. But I've just done a whole rewrite where I had to ask myself some really, really hard questions about the plot and the motivation of my character. It hasn't been a straightforward process. I think I've had to rewrite the whole thing probably about four times so far. And it feels like a first draft now. So now I'm ready for proper proper edits again. If all is well, it should come out in the US kind of late autumn or late next year, fingers crossed.
And you have a slightly different situation in that your book has, that's, how can I word this, so you have a two book deal in the US, and in the UK you have a one book deal. So once the book is done, you'll then have to, it will be out in America, but you'll have to go back on submission in the UK to make it even more complicated.
Yeah, because us writers love being on submission. Yes. You know, we love kind of refreshing emails every 5 minutes, jumping every time the phone call, and it's always, you know, somebody from your family.
Just when you're waiting for that all-important call. Yeah,
exactly. That empty phone screen. But I find it actually quite exciting. But you know, we'll just see what happens. I know I'm going to carry on writing anyway. So I've got a few ideas for the next books. I'm not really physically ready to throw myself into book three, but I know it will happen at some point. So, you know, whatever happens in terms of submission happens. It was the book I really, really wanted to write. And I'm really pleased that I'm working on it with my amazing US editor. And we'll see what the final finished product looks like. But I hope it will all work out, obviously, but we'll see.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. And I think often the books that come from people's hearts are the ones that have a deeper meaning and a deeper resonance for us, that often the ones that kind of touch readers as well. So I wish you good luck in the UK with it, Sarah.
But thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
That was Sarah Yost talking about her contemporary novel, One Last Chance, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.